Welcome to Choice Conversations. I'm your host, Chris Stefanik. Today I have with me Andrew Horowitz. He's the president and founder of Horowitz & Company, the author of the best-selling book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, as well as the creator of the blog and podcast titled The Disciplined Investor. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
Good.
How about yourself?
I'm good. Everything's good down here in sunny South Florida.
Nice, nice.
Not that I get to see the sun that often, but I hear it's nice.
Hey, you have your own company. There's no reason you can't take your laptop outside or...
I suppose, but you know what? It's, on the weekends, I guess, but during the week, it's kind of, it doesn't matter if I was in the middle of Arkansas or Alaska. It's kind of four walls and a bunch of people that work with me and all that. So, it's good stuff.
I hear you. So, why don't you tell us about your journey, you know, how you reached this point in your life, how you developed your strategies and how you've built and grown Horowitz & Company.
All right. So, well, I mean, I've been doing this for, 25 years or so. And, you know, it's an ever-evolving process, the world of investing, because when you think about in the last 25 or maybe 50 or 100 years, the environment of investing has changed so dramatically. You know, back in the day, there was why we call it the street or the curb. It was actually people, you know, doing auction-based type of buying and selling of securities.
Right.
And even when I was young in this business, I mean, it was the New York Stock Exchange was the big thing. And, you know, you had always looking at the end of the day of the floor of the exchange and what was going on there. And the only way you could really buy and sell things were by either some kind of a direct link with the company or maybe a telephone. And these days, it's, you know, a wholly different object. In the beginning of my career, there really wasn't any ETFs. So you had to use either mutual funds. Many of them were load mutual funds. And then, you know, they developed into the no load versions that you finally got that you could do something with. And there was things like, you know, you had to dig through data to find out if it was really a fund that did what it said it did.
Right.
And, you know, stocks were, there was more of a mystery. There wasn't as much disclosure and there was a lot of inside, more than today, a lot of insider things going on and communications were hard to get. News was at the end of the day. So, you know, what happened was you start learning the basics. And I think actually it's a good thing because you need to learn the fundamentals. And I mean the core of how something operates, whether it's the markets, whether it's, you know, whatever job you may do, to understand how really to, embody what the process is and what you need to do. So I'm kind of happy that there was no shortcuts back then that, you know, you had to take. It was understanding the base of all of this. So, fast forward a number of years, and as things were progressing and changing, and particularly when computers were available to do things, Excel spreadsheets, all that, and data was accessible, I started developing a variety of different theories and work that would be able to be used that would, you know, hopefully have a good repeatable process, because in investing, you want to be able to repeat success and not repeat failure. And that doesn't mean that in any 1 year, 2 year, I mean, I'm talking about long time period.
Sure.
So, you know, kind of looked at a lot of different technical indicators and I like those and kind of worked through those and some fundamental analysis work and quantitative analysis. And then, again, put it together one day and said, you know, why don't we use all three of these to come up with a solution to find stocks, then to identify their quality, their fundamentals, and then to find out when to invest or not to invest. So kind of evolved that and did a lot of economic work to understand how the big monster works in terms of the economy. And when I put that all together, we kind of had a nice way of managing money for clients back, you know, 20-something years ago. And kind of been evolving it ever since, changing strategies to try to keep up with the current state of the market condition and also the current desire of investors. Some want more actively involved investing, some want more of a traditional laid back approach. So, you know, put that all together and it's kind of where we are today, managing many different strategies by really the use of a lot of technical help in order to make sure that monitoring happens and all that. So not to bore you to death, but it's been a process is the point.
Right, right. So as the markets have changed, like you said, all these new products are available now. It's very easy for an average investor to invest in gold, to invest in foreign markets mm-hmm. with these cheap online trading brokers, with the ETFs and the like. And of course, the technical analysis is so widespread, it's kind of like the cat's out of the bag. I mean, do you think it's now more difficult because of that? Now, like, the playing field is leveled. I've listened to interviews with some of the old investors, the Richard Dent and these people that they would just do just simple trend following back 60s, 70s, and would just get filthy rich, loaded, you know?
Right, absolutely. And it
seems like a lot of those strategies, they might still be profitable, but they're not nearly as good as what they used to be. I mean, have you witnessed that yourself?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's no question about that. I always talk about how, hey, you know what? The old indicators of a simple trending or an oscillating indicator that look for overbought or oversold, or maybe looking for specific trends that are moving in one direction, you can just draw a straight line across, or maybe looking at support and resistant lines has made it was very good for a long time because that was available. And in a way, that's what everybody used. You know, and you still have the 50-day moving average, 200-day moving average, MACD, RSI, stochastics. But you know what? These days, that is considered a little bit outdated. Not that it's bad, but outdated. There's better ways, that I have found at least, to look at markets that are operating correctly without the extra hand of the central banks. Let's talk about just, you know, trying to find true price value inside
of
a security.
All right. So wait, hold on a second. You know of some markets that aren't affected by the hand of the central banks? No. Can you point me towards those?
Yeah. No kidding. It really is quite amazing that, I don't know if you know this, but since 2008, there's been about 515 individual cuts in interest rates around the world.
Wow.
And there's another one today and yesterday and the day before. I mean, this really the last couple of weeks has been a slew of them. And it just goes to show you that the world economy, while stocks are better, let's kind of put that aside for a second. While the world economy is having some real problems, because if you have to continue to pump in liquidity and open up to lower interest rates, there's a real concern that, you know, what's happening? You know, why is all this extra priming needed on a continual basis to keep the economies, you know, moving ahead? And why isn't the work that they've done this far, putting this much money into the system, able to spark enough of a move that it is self-sustaining? I mean, that's a real interesting question. And again, putting stocks aside, you got to put that aside.
Sure.
And wonder how come that's not happened yet.
Right. I'm right there with you. I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons we could talk about why some of those might be demographics and the like, and the overhanging debt.
Yeah, that's all above.
Right.
Clearly.
So I guess I'm curious, when you're evaluating the economy and you see kind of these red lights in the economy, and meanwhile, all systems are go in the stock market, everything's going up. How does your evaluation of the economy affect how you manage stocks?
Well, that's a really good question because, first of all, the economy is really important when it's important.
Right.
And when it's not important, and a good example is what's happening recently, is that the, you know, we're in this weird mode that no matter what the information is, it seems to drive stocks higher, or at least it doesn't really hurt stocks too badly. We see a real downdraft in economics in terms of manufacturing. Jobs numbers are a little bit better, of course. We're seeing that there's a drag because retail sales are really not there. GDP is just, you know, moderate at best. And those scenarios should really be affecting, you know, markets, and it should really be affecting the way that investors are thinking, but it's not. And again, one of the reasons is that there is so much pressure being put on stock markets by central banks and by all sorts of exits from different areas around the world. Money wants to leave Japan. Money wants to leave China. Money wants to leave much of Latin America. And where are they going to go? You're going to put your money in Europe, even though the stock market has done much better there. You know, it's done better, you know, even though it shouldn't have been. You know, you want to put your money in the U.S. That's the place that everybody seems to think that is the best, at least the cleanest shirt in a very dirty closet. You know, so when you look at the economics, they will matter one day. I mean, they will matter. Earnings will matter. The fact that revenues are slowing dramatically and we have the biggest gap in a number of years between the earnings growth and revenue growth is going to matter, because there's only so much you can cut, so much expenses you can, you know, really put into or take out of the equation. And there's so much, at least at this point, re-engineering of technology that you can use to make yourself more efficient. You know, that being said, you know, we've coined the phrase consumption cannibalism a few years ago, where, you know, you have a factory and the factory is making X amount of widgets. And now, you know, they're pumping out X amount per day. And you realize, wait a second, we can have machinery that does that. We can have actually a system that goes in and creates, you know, whatever the amount is times five, and it's going to be a cost factor to bring in that robotics or those that technology. And there's going to be a little bit of a transition, but once it's over, we no longer have to pay the health insurance, worry about sick days and pension plans, worry about people coming in, coming out, hiring, firing, and all that. We have this machine that will do a lot of the work of maybe, let's say, you know, 10% of the workforce.
Right.
The problem is, here's the problem. Machines don't eat, they don't drink, they don't dress, they don't go to the bathroom. That's all good and bad at the same time. So we're kind of now in a world that we've created this technology. For example, you know, is there any reason to have a file clerk anymore?
Right.
You know, what do you need a file clerk for? You know, do you need a switchboard operator? There are ways to handle all of that through technology that has really allowed for companies to become much more meaner and leaner. And that's why we have so many displaced workers in the U.S.
Right.
You know, even though we have a better unemployment rate, the labor participation rate, which is the number of people really working and all that, is just shrunk up to a decade low.
Yeah. I don't know how much you listen to James Dines, but he talks about the coming age of robots and the age of no jobs.
Yeah.
Basically that same thought.
Yeah, we're in the rise of the machines. There's no question about that. I mean, it is the rise of the machines. I don't think it will go that far to a point that, you know, we exclude human beings entirely, at least for a number of hundred years. But, you know, if you think about it, really, there are so many jobs that have been just entirely displaced, not only because of hiring in cheaper labor areas, but just in our, you know, think about a car plant, you know, think about the assembly line, you know, think about just there's so many things that aren't required to be done anymore. I mean, you could just think back to when a horse had to plow a field. You don't need that anymore. You have combines that do it 10 times faster, overall cheaper. I mean, you know, this just goes on and on. The revolution of this creation of new things to, you know, quote unquote, save us time. Like, hey, the internet really, you know, really saved us a lot of time. The smartphone really saved us time. I don't know about you. It's 24/7 now. It used to be at least to be able to be shut off for a while.
Right.
You know, so there's no time anymore. So to answer your question, just to get back to that, the economics do matter. We think it matters a lot. But the problem is you have to also yield to what the market says. Because when we look at a number and we see that it's dropping, whatever that is, or it's rising, and we say, well, you know what, markets should and this and that, and they don't, well, what are you going to do? You're going to pick a fight? What are you going to do? You know, right. This is what it is. And if markets choose, for whatever reason, to totally ignore the material and the facts, there must be another reason why that is. And whatever that reason is, you have to assume is a good reason.
Right. So I guess what would that look like? So my thinking is you're looking at the economy is dipping, the stock market is trending up. So maybe that means you tighten your stops. Now let's go on the other side. The economy is going up. The market is starting to go sideways or maybe dip down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of tightening stops, now you're looking to buy the dips because the economy is going up. Is that how that translates into your strategy?
I mean, it does. It's a pretty scary proposition, though. If I agree with you, the economy is going up, you know, you buy the dips in theory. But, you know, again, just to kind of put it in the current context, everything is buy the dips right now. You know, in the last couple of days, we saw a bunch of dips pre-market that just got blown out and were bought almost every time. You see strange things happening, like companies issuing shares and stocks go up afterwards, which is usually a dilutive mechanism and, you know, all sorts of problems with that. You're seeing that earnings are coming in sometimes weak and, you know, they don't care about that. So it's more of you can't do anything all the time. But yes, buying the dip, we're not really thrilled with buying a dip in terms of unless it's really a hard, you know, not just a small dip. I mean, if it's something that really comes in, that's prolonged, that looks like we're seeing a turn, hey, that's a good place to buy. Buying the dip these days is every, you know, 3 points on the S&P 500, which is but ridiculous.
Right.
You know, you can't see, you know, God forbid the stock market's down for a day or two.
Right.
You know, people, I don't know what would happen. There'd be riots and then people would be crazed, I guess, I assume. I don't know. I mean, you know, we haven't seen it. But one of the big reasons, if just to kind of fast forward to that, is that there's so much money in the system that it's almost to a point of being ridiculous. Margin levels, the amount of money borrowed against stock accounts to buy into more stocks, are at the highest they've been since 2008 and almost at a record.
Sure.
the money that is being utilized, it seems to me, if you can kind of trace the money, there's the only thing we can come up with that makes sense. There's so much money that was flooded into the markets, or at least potentially flooded into the markets, by the approval of the dropping of the yen by the Japanese economic ministers, and the follow-up kind of thumbs-up winks by the G7 and G20, that it's almost a green light to sell the yen and do something with the money.
Sure.
And, you know, we're starting to see a point where, okay, that happened, and happened, you know, almost on a fully correlated basis. When the yen went down, the markets went up and all that. Clearly that happens in Japan. Funny enough, Japanese GDP came out. It was better than expected. And what do you expect happened to the stock market? It went down. So, you know, kind of thinking that the markets are getting better sometimes is an inverse situation, because, you know, if the markets really do get better and employment gets better, in theory, the Fed's going to step away. And this is a big issue. We have not only a punch bowl, they call it, that was spiked with some serious vodka, okay?
Right.
Recently, grain alcohol was poured into it to top it off. So that's kind of where we are now, and we got everybody hooked on this. And, you know, they liken sometimes the whole idea of, you know, the markets being like a heroin addict, where you take away the heroin and, man, people get freaky. That's why we continue to get the leaks through the Wall Street Journal about potential things they're going to do, not do. Bonds are moving crazy. There's been many days, which this doesn't make sense, where bonds are being bought like crazy, but stocks are being bought too.
Right.
And then gold is being bought. And then, you know, gold drops down really hard, and then it's just brought back up. Crude oil is the big mystery of it all. Fundamentally, it shouldn't be where it is. Inventories are the highest they've been since 1931 on a monthly basis. If you look at the weekly numbers, it's back 20 years or so, the highest inventories. And meanwhile, the dollar's come up to 83, 83 and a half, and oil's still in the 94, 95 range.
Right.
It should be in the 80s,
right.
You know, and not to mention we have more efficiency on our vehicles. We're pumping more oil here. Saudis are pumping more oil. So there's a lot of discrepancies out there right now. And you can only explain it by thinking, hey, all this money is now been at least it's cheap and available. And somehow it leaks into the economies, or it leaks into the markets better than that. It leaks into the markets, not the economies.
Right. Well, Andrew, I want to be respectful of your time. Before I let you go, do you have a few minutes to talk about your TDI managed growth strategy? And maybe our listeners would be interested in that.
Yep.
You kind of have a unique product where people, they still have their own accounts, and they can see what you're doing in their accounts and learn from that.
Mm-hmm.
And you give them updates and weekly conference calls and like. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So we have a variety of different strategies. And going back all these years, we've had what's called our global allocation strategies, which is several different risk levels of a more traditional approach. But what happened was back in 2007, 2006, 2008, there was a big calling for us to do a lot of things we were doing for some clients, but on a much bigger scale. And the idea was, hey, we could take lower minimums if we set it up properly. And we do that by having individuals have their own accounts, like you mentioned, at a brokerage. So it's all theirs. All we have access is to do the trading on their accounts. It's an actively traded account. We go short, we go long. We sometimes use options in it. But the nice thing is that people know what they have. We have a private blog where we write every day that is only for clients of this strategy. And we talk about some of the things we did. For example, yesterday and the day before, we were busy shorting Tesla in and out a few different times, made a few bucks on that. We were short oil. We came out of it. We went back short. You know, why we're shorting the Japanese market right now, why we're long this position, or just talking about the economics. So everybody gets not only the opportunity to be involved, because some people like to be very involved. Some people like just do what I don't want to hear from you. And then at the same time, they have a learning process, because we put up charts and say, hey, look, this is the level we said it was, and this is why we want to do this, whether it worked or didn't work, but this is what the intent was. And, you know, people seem to really like that. And because there is that transparency, and at the same time, again, we do quite a bit of trading in there. We may hold a position for, you know, a day, a week, a year, depending on, as I always say, we love the position as long as it loves us. But we try to set some very reasonable levels of short term, you know, in terms of days, weeks, price targets and stops in there, and have that as our overriding mechanism. And at the same time, we may be long the markets, we may hedge the markets, we may be short the markets or out of the markets. So it's kind of an eclectic style that goes along with a lot of technical analysis and a core set of positions that we have, and then a secondary set of trading positions.
Right. So where can my listeners find out more?
You just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and there's a little box on the right there that says, you know, if you want to see more, there's like a 12-minute virtual tour that you can check out and just see what it's all about and just understand a little bit more about the strategy and how we do things.
Right. And I'll go ahead and link that in the show notes. And I could also give a plug to your podcast. I listen to it every week. Really do a good job of recapping the action and getting some great guests and the like. So I would recommend that.
I appreciate that. Thanks. And you got a great show, and I appreciate you having me on.
All right. Now take care, Andrew.
Hey, be well, buddy.
All right.
Bye-bye.